broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to The Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Welcome, listeners, to another episode of The Investor Exchange. I'm your host today, Louis Van Copenhagen. Joining me is my regular co-pilot, Joel Hewish.
Morning, Louis. Morning, listeners.
Good morning. And joining us today is special guest star, Hugh Davies.
Morning, morning.
Introducing Hugh, the head analyst and trader at United Global Capital, formerly of HSBC in London, Deutsche Bank in London, and Morgan Stanley.
Yep. Looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Welcome, Hugh. Yeah, welcome. Good to have you on board, mate. You've just joined the team about, 3 weeks ago? 4 weeks ago?
First of October. So
1st of October. Okay. So, Jesus, five weeks in. Jeez, time flies when you're having fun,
flown by. Yeah. Now, Hugh, podcasting is probably not your natural game. I imagine your natural game is staring at a computer screen, looking at what I call the squiggly lines.
That would be correct.
First time
on a podcast.
That's okay.
It's a little bit awkward sitting here looking at everyone in the room.
We'll be gentle, mate.
Look, you should have a look at it from our perspective.
That's right. We'll hold your hand. You can take deep breaths, and it's only going out to a million people who yes. subscribe to our podcast.
Exactly.
That's right. Yes. We have hit 1 million subscribers, by the way. No, we haven't.
No.
I'm lying.
No.
Yeah. All right.
Don't worry, it'll be lost in that deep pit of irrelevance soon.
The growing pile of internet content.
Yep.
Fantastic.
The only problem is it stays there forever, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. Yeah, that's right.
A bit like pictures on Facebook.
Yeah,
that's exactly right.
Well, you know what this means. If this is going to be your number one Google rank for people searching for you, you need to come up with some more content.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, yep. This and a photo from 1997 with, you know, three beers in your hands.
And some hair.
Exactly.
Oh, very good. Now, Hugh, you're an investment analyst of 19 years' experience across a few major organisations. So I take it you've seen some pretty interesting things in your time.
Yeah. 19 years in the industry, in finance, across Australia and in the UK. Seen some pretty interesting scenarios play out. Seen a lot of very different operating models in different businesses, from investment banks to smaller boutique wealth managers, fund managers, as well as a big part of my career I spent in London from 2004 to 2009. And
that would have been pretty exciting during that period.
I was before the GFC hit, and just after the GFC I was operating in London, and that was, you know, you talk about a contrast of lifestyles.
Before and after the global financial crisis.
The bubble of London, probably in finance and investment banking, you really saw the two extremes.
Which was
all really, really interesting and really exciting.
And what was your role when you were working at Deutsche and HSBC? What were you doing then?
So I got to London 2004. Fresh off being a ski bum living in Whistler,
yep.
And landed a job at Deutsche Bank through a friend of mine in the OTC derivatives part of the business it's global investment banking and markets, but it was in their OTC derivatives, this sort of middle office, back office.
So just for listeners, OTC means over the counter.
Yep.
So if you're not aware, most securities are traded on a listed exchange like the ASX, but there are some derivatives, some securities that banks do with one another directly without a formal exchange in place, and that's what we call over-the-counter.
Correct. I was lucky enough to get there at the pinnacle, I guess, of the credit default swap market, or CDS market.
All of the stuff that blew up in the GFC.
Exactly, yep. Mm. There when Deutsche Bank, so that at that time, Deutsche Bank and JP Morgan were the two biggest counterparties in the CDS market. And to be honest, I had no experience in swaps.
Yep.
All they needed were bums on seats, people right. who had worked in finance and bums on seats, because their volumes were out of control. And so being over the counter, your risk systems are not really there to manage the pricing risk and the transactional risk as well. So it was sheets of paper, well, more than sheets. They were 10-page documents per contract.
Right.
And you'd have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds going through every day.
So you were working in the swaps market. So this is where different institutions would swap their interest rate exposure. Is that right?
With one another? So you could. So that was one aspect of it.
Yep.
The area I specialised in initially, the credit default swaps, was credit very much swaps. Around.
Which is essentially insurance against default.
Yeah, ultimately it's an insurance policy against the underlying issuer, against their ability to pay their obligation. They didn't like to call it insurance because traders on the London trading desk were all Oxford, Yale, Harvard. They didn't want to be called insurance sales.
So credit default swap sounds sexier, did it?
It certainly did. Certainly did. But in its, if you go right back to what it actually does, it is very much like an insurance policy. You hold $100 million worth of ANZ debt, and you're worried that counterparty might have a few payment issues, or you just want to reduce your risk to that counterparty, then you might buy a credit default swap on a portion of that exposure, and for that you'd receive. So you've got to pay your counterparty a fee, and they essentially insure you in case of default.
Now, is it similar in the way that an option might work, where you pay a premium, and so you only have to put down a small proportion of the amount of for the amount of coverage you want, and then you get these big magnified swings depending on whether or not the creditworthiness changes?
Yeah, essentially it's a lot like that. You pay a premium. Sorry, you pay an interest rate.
Yep.
So it might be a couple of basis points.
Sure.
To cover you, and the person who sold you the protection, so they're going to receive that fee.
Yep.
The counterparty who sold the protection, though, their risk is if there is a default, they've got to deliver the bond.
Wow.
So they've got to deliver the cash.
Yeah, right.
So it ends up being a swap of the bond for the cash. That the risk of the counterparty, the seller of protection, their risk is that an issuer like ANZ defaults on a loan, on a specific loan, and they have to deliver 100 cents on the dollar.
Yeah.
And the piece of paper they get back is only really worth 70 cents.
Yeah.
So that's the payoff. And calculating the value is a fairly complex task for a CDS. There's a lot of moving parts in it. It's a lot like an option. You get some differences because it's over the counter and very much a product that is tailored to the issuer and the counterparties.
Yeah.
There were times where the buyer of the protection would have to pay an upfront premium as well.
Right.
And typically that was hedge funds who would have to pay that premium. And that was a reflection of the counterparty risk. So an investment bank like HSBC would trade with GLG Partners or Mann Colquhoun, and they would issue that protection, but they'd have to pay a fee, which would be a small percentage.
Yeah.
And that was their way of protecting, I guess, that cash flow initially.
But
so
just,
let me see if I've got this right. Yeah. So one party wants the protection against the loan and a default on a loan that they've got on their books.
Yep.
And so there'd be like an insurance, say a 2 or 3% premium against that insurance. And if there was a claimable event, well, then there would be a swap of the debt, which is now at a reduced value because it might be in a default position, for cash.
Cash, correct. Yeah.
So so there might be an insurance premium of 2 or 3%, and then in a claim, then the insurer takes on the debt, which is now not worth 100%. It might now be worth 60 or 70%.
Yeah, in a,
or
in
something
a,
like
yeah,
that. And so it's not from 100 to 0, it's from 100 to 60 or 70.
Yeah, that would be correct. And the what occurs is what they call an auction, where because it's when there's an issuer that defaults, it's not just one holder who is in strife. There could be 60 or 70 banks that are holding that debt, and 60 or 70 banks that are holding protection. So they'll have a price auction.
Yep.
So they may come to an agreed value on, because a credit event can be a number of different things. It can be a restructuring. Doesn't necessarily have to be default.
Right.
It can be a restructuring of that debt.
Yep.
So anything that really changes the terms of that initial issuance.
Yeah.
So for the places that you were working, as long as they would do a decent number of them, so if they wrote 15 or 20 of these contracts, then they would be in a profit position if one of those 20 ended up being a claim. So if you're collecting 2 or 3%, you do it 20 times and you've essentially collected maybe 50% out of the 100 that you're insured for, and then if there's one claim, then you're 100%, you're out of pocket by maybe 30 or 40%.
Yeah. What,
and you've got a profit.
What would often happen is the banks would hold – They'd issue the protection, but they'd also still hold the bond. So they'd be buying the bond in the market,
okay,
as well.
Yep.
So that they, but that was kind of how they reduced their risk. But then, the beauty of leverage through that period, people started to trade them naked, so they could. Now that doesn't mean traders were sitting on the desk with no clothes on.
Oh, you had me excited for a second.
They'd be selling protection without holding that underlying bond.
So, I imagine it's
so their risk and return would alter their idea. You know, I guess the payoff for them is if they sell the protection naked, nothing happens. They've just got whatever it might be on a $10 million notional, and they'll have collected over 2 or 3 years. Call it 200 basis point annual, US it was quarterly, European semi-annual, I think.
Probably lining up with when their earnings reports were and profit reports were.
Yeah. And I also suspect there was probably a lot of, banks, these guys all had a very deep understanding of the balance sheet and capital structure of a lot of these companies because they were the bankers for it. Yeah. So, They always had a very clear idea as to what their payoff should be, but it became very profitable because the volumes were so high. And trading naked was what they did. And to give you an idea, in 2007 or 2008, I remember sitting at my desk with a colleague, and we'd been we knew there was some trouble coming, and everyone. Knew a few people tried really, I suppose, to deny from it. They sort of hide under the covers a little bit.
Correct me if I'm wrong here. John Paulson, the very famous hedge fund manager, actually used credit default swaps, did he not, to make a shit ton of money when the market crashed? I believe he was creating credit default swaps on mortgage loans out of the United States.
I believe he was, as well as
Michael Burry.
Yeah. The great book and movie, The Big Short.
The Big Short, yes.
The movie's a very condensed version of that, but if you read the book, it's a lot more detail. And
so if you've ever seen the movie The Big Short, essentially the way that these guys profited from a declining in the housing market in the United States, which pretty much filtered all around most of Western Europe as well, was by taking out these credit default swaps and betting actually against these loans going bad.
Yeah. So they
stood to make a ton of money.
Their view was the loans will go bad and everyone's going to want our protection.
Yeah.
And sure enough, that's what they did. In the movie, it does. So there's the other guys. The company escapes me at the moment, but where they had issued through Deutsche Bank, they bought. They'd taken some credit default swaps through Deutsche Bank.
That's right. That's Steve. Yeah.
Steve Carell plays the guy.
Yeah, that's
in the
right.
Movie.
Steve Carell plays it. That's right.
And those guys, there's a scene in the movie where they're at Moody's or Standard & Poor's talking about the ratings and the pricing because these instruments are very difficult to price. There's no exchange. People don't, if you don't have to mark to market.
Steve Eisman, that's
right.
He was the hedge fund manager who was Steve Carell in the movie.
Yep. And so it was difficult to reprice, so difficult to value.
And also there was some shenanigans going on with
banks
the pricing
wanna,
as well.
Yeah, banks didn't want to value it, and they didn't have to. You know, they didn't want to mark it to market. And then so a lot of those guys were, as you see in the movie, they were stinging because they were on the right side of the deal.
But the banks weren't repricing.
But there was no repricing, so they were getting hammered. But
In fact, the banks were actually jacking up the prices when they should have been actually pushing them down. But because it was this opaque market for, you know,
you couldn't price it.
Well, and they could get away with coming up with ridiculous pricing until almost it became obvious that they could no longer keep that pricing there.
Yeah. So that was a really interesting time. But at that. Getting back to my point, there was, we talk about the size of this market, and it was, I think, at the height in 07 was about 60 trillion.
60
notional
trillion.
Exposure.
Wow. So
global GDP, I think, was about 50 or 60 trillion at that point.
So the market for credit default,
so that was credit
swaps,
default swaps
was larger than the global economy.
Yep. And when you go to OTC derivatives as a whole, it's something like $600 trillion worth of notional exposure. Now that's the total value of the underlying notional exposure.
Yeah. But then that's all hedged out and covered.
Yeah, if you look at the total value, I guess, of the contracts at $600 trillion, it's about $25 trillion. So it's still massive.
Yeah.
I think at one point of all non-finance issued debt, the amount of CDS on issue or the amount of CDS notional exposure was 10 times.
Wow.
So let's go back to what was the sense on the ground for you working in that environment? You said that there was a bit of a sense that something was coming.
Yeah, we around being in the middle office and back office at that time, what you would often say is a very it was a small world.
Yeah.
Investment banking in London. Like it's 25 people across the 14, 15 biggest banks, and that's from London to New York.
Because you're all doing the same thing.
You're all doing the same thing. You're talking to each other all day, every day, your emails, your phone calls.
Are you looking at each other as competitors or are you looking at each other as
when I first
frenemies
got there,
or how does it work?
When I first started, it was competitor.
Yeah.
And, you know, at Deutsche Bank, we were the biggest.
Yep.
And we could kind of throw our weight around a little bit and tell people this is what we want. Because the contracts were, when I started, the contracts were not standardized.
Right.
They were going through a process of standardization.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, and a lot of, you know, they're talking about, you know, what days, business days constituted a default.
Yeah, right.
You know, if it happened on Christmas Day, which day did, was it Christmas Eve or was it,
all the nuances.
All of those sorts of things. And for a lot of people, I think, well, it's a couple of days. But if you're talking about your total notional value of $600 trillion.
Yeah, that
2 days of interest is a pretty big number.
Yeah.
So those things were all very relevant.
What were you saying? So coming back to Louis's question, what were you saying in the in your world? How did you sort of get a sense that something was going awry?
What we started to see were emerging markets sovereign debt. That was the contracts, the cost to cover on those contracts was blowing right out. So
and when was this happening? Was this 2006, 2007? So
this was I reckon this was back end of 2006,
right,
into 2007.
So you could see the warning signs. Twelve months out from the actual peak in the stock market.
And in the UK, there were housing prices were off the charts. People were able to 110% mortgages.
Yeah.
The US market, I remember sitting in at HSBC. So 2005, I was at HSBC.
Yeah.
So into 2006, 2007, I remember sitting at an earnings meeting and they were talking about the HSBC purchase of a US subprime lender, which they'd done many years before.
Right.
And they HSBC said, and we've suffered $10 billion loss in that, but we've still, as a group, reported a $13 billion profit.
Wow.
And you're sort of thinking, you've just taken a $10 billion loss.
Yeah.
But they hadn't even they hadn't written that down to zero.
Right. That still had further to go.
Still had further to go. I think for 2 or 3 years it went $10 billion and then $8 billion and then I think it sort of, after that, it started to settle. Because it did rebound.
Right.
That business that they bought, but there was toxic assets in there. So they had to reach their fair value and eventually they did.
So you started seeing these canaries in the coal mine.
And I wasn't, you'd be talking with my partner at the time. She was working at, it's probably Citigroup, I think. And a couple of other friends still at Deutsche Bank, and you'd be out having a beer and chatting and talking about what's going on, and you could tell just by the way people looked, whether they were really tired because you're working 6 till 10, and just talking to each other. What's your Lehman's exposure like, or what's your emerging markets exposure, what's your Middle East exposure? So sort of understand, a big issue that used to occur was, you'd have the trades would get done, and that'd be registered on the P&L for the traders book, but then you'd have that contractual obligation that hadn't been completed,
right?
Which outlined credit events, outlined everything, and often you'd find that there were massive backlogs, 200 days, and all of these.
So you'd do
things,
a trade, but yet the terms of the trade hadn't yet been finalised.
Essentially, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was so as I. Yeah.
What's the deal? We'll work that out later.
Give me 2% on 100 mil for the next 3 years. The terms out later. If you look at it, that's kind of what it looked like.
And this was what the backbone of our economy was, the global economy was built on, I guess, leading into the GFC. Wow. No wonder we had such an issue.
Yeah. But it was, you'd be just having conversations, and you could feel that as some of those prices, that those interest payments were ramping right up, because you'd see stuff from 2 years ago that might be a Middle Eastern sovereign debt, and it might be 3% from 2 years ago, and it's just had a you've assigned it, or you've partially terminated the deal on the value, and it was maybe 2.5-3%. New deal comes through at 5.5%.
So the
cost to insure it had gone through the roof.
Yeah, okay.
And you started to see that more and more and more. And then
it's interesting you say that, because I always talk about looking at the stress in financial systems and looking for financial or credit stress as a key warning sign for when we might be getting close to a recession. And this has been a key reason as to why I've been saying that, no, things are actually pretty good right now, because we haven't seen that stress. We haven't seen those spreads widen between high grade debt and low grade debt. We haven't seen the number of defaults start to rise at this point in time. But
usually those types of events will happen months, even possibly a year or two before the peak actually peak in stock prices and asset prices and a recession starts to hit. You can actually see these warning signs months and up to a year or so before the big one comes.
And there are a few people, not many, but there are a few people talking about a big crash coming and a repeat happening. Hugh, how do you feel in today's environment compared to that environment? On a scale of 1 to 10, if that was a 10 in terms of absolutely crazy, where would we be right now, just as a gut feel?
I'd look at, say, using the experience that I got being on that OTC, being exposed to those OTC products and how the operationally, and I think you talk to any of the CEOs at that time, they probably say, yeah, operationally we weren't quite there to deal with the risk. Mm-hmm. Everyone had measures in place, but on the back of all of that, it's completely changed. So now, all those products are essentially done in electronic. They're still traded over the counter, but the details of them are now held in central warehouses, essentially.
So there's registers, there's better accounting, pen and paper
it's
anymore.
It's all about so they can actually understand what it actually looks like. So,
they can understand what they're trading in.
That's right.
They can actually see. Now they understand that when they're looking at their notional, they don't have 10 times the issuance anymore because they'll go through processes where they'll reduce. If a bank's got 25 positions in one counterpart, in one issuer across a whole lot of counterparties, so they'll do transactions where everyone will put all their positions in together, and then they run algorithms all over it, and then you end up, if you're ANZ, you end up with $100 million worth of credit default swap risk on your book to a specific counterparty that you've dealt with. So that was all designed to sort of contract the total.
So what you're saying is it really can't happen again.
I don't think I'm not going to say it can't happen again because it could at some point, whether it's
conditions
would have to deteriorate significantly. And I think we have a lot more transparency around, those, as Warren Buffett called them, the weapons of mass destruction. There's so much more transparency around those that regulators and the banks can understand them. Whether they do the right or wrong thing is up to the banks, but the regulators have a greater vision as to what's going on. So I think another GFC event from one asset class, I think we're probably a long way away from that. Mm-hmm. But, I'm sure when the Great Depression hit, everyone said, we think that it probably won't be as big as that.
Yep.
But something in at some point in our lifetimes, there'll be another one or two that'll happen. Yeah. I think we'd be naive to think that it'll never happen.
Just one question before we go to a break. So you were there in the heady days of pre-GFC time. Tell us what it was like working for an investment bank where money was just slushing around everywhere, and then tell us the contrast that it was like when you when things weren't so flash.
Well, it was pretty loose. From, say, 2004 until 2007, the Christmas parties were off the charts.
Yeah.
They were crazy. Yeah, Deutsche Bank would have every second year they'd have an entire Deutsche Bank Christmas party. So that's everyone in London. It'd be all of London. And then you'd end up with half the US trading desk there. And everyone.
So they'd fly in from the US just for the Christmas party.
Just for the Christmas party.
Yeah.
To see clients, but it was for the Christmas
party.
And these weren't Christmas parties at a hall where you had a whole lot of tables. They were themed. They'd be at high-end private clubs.
Yeah.
I remember in 2007 we had – 2006 – we had at HSBC, we had a for all of London Christmas party, and there was a big blank spot at a big empty area at Canary Wharf. Some clever firm had erected a ginormous marquee and had pitched every bank in Canary Wharf, and every bank had their giant parties there. These were places. So at Canary Wharf in the HSBC Tower, I think there were 7,500 employees.
Right.
So that's just Canary Wharf, and then they had Square Mile. It's probably a couple of thousand. So there'd be, call it 10,000 people.
Yeah.
That's HSBC. I hate to think what JP Morgan or Barclays or those guys. So they were – and they were huge.
Yeah.
And it was an open bar.
No expenses spared.
No expenses spared. Now, that was – they were pretty awesome parties. And, you know, you'd have circus themed.
Mm.
But where the excess really got pre-GFC was when you went out we'd be out two or three times a week.
After work.
With colleagues. And you'd be hanging out with your counterparts at different banks as well because you get to know each other pretty well. And it was every week you're out. And it wasn't just to the pub. You'd be out at the pub, then you'd go out to the nightclubs. And you know, you might buy, instead of buying a vodka tonic, you're buying a bottle of vodka. And yeah, you know, it was all about being a bit showy. And you know, 2006, I think it was, I remember going out with our emerging market guys at HSBC and we're at Bougie in London, one of the frequented by Premier League footballers, royalty, and all of that. And you talk about a bottle of champagne, right? The big bottle of champagne, the Magnum of crew.
Yep.
Now that was standard fare. What you would see is the Methuselah.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, 4.5 litres.
Oh, gosh.
So you'd see people turn up and, you can barely carry it. You know, the girls carrying these bottles could barely carry them from the bar to these private booths.
Wow.
And then someone would walk by and they'd have two bottles of Grey Goose or two Magnums of Grey Goose vodka. With sparklers coming out the top, and there's 10 people. It was
wild.
And then you'd read stories in the paper of, you know, some bankers being at a nightclub and dropping £35,000 for the night.
Wow!
Yeah, and that's on the back of getting a probably £1 million bonus.
Yeah.
So it was out of control. You'd see guys. I remember one day at the gym, looking out the window at HSBC, down into Canary Wharf, you see a truck pull up.
Yeah.
It's got six cars on it. There would have been two Aston Martins, two Lamborghinis, a Ferrari and something else. They literally back them off, drive them down you'd see them go into a couple of different car parks.
Crazy.
And out would come, you know, a two-year-old BMW X5 or whatever. Jeez. So they were just trading up. And you'd see through that bonus season, you'd see – four or five of those events. Wow. So people were spending obscene money.
Yeah.
Wow.
Then GFC hit.
Yeah. What was that like?
And people just were, so we go back to the cars.
Yeah.
So you buy cars for, you know, a third of what they were 18 months beforehand. You know, £100,000 car you can buy for £30,000.
Yeah.
And a lot of bankers and hedge fund managers and all of that, they just look at, what's a depreciating asset? Get rid of it. So they just flog cars, get rid of them.
Yeah.
So if you're in the secondhand car market, you did quite well.
I bet.
But you would also, the other thing that would happen is being an expat, you know, you'd be out having a beer with a whole lot of friends and that community 1 week. Next week, you do the same thing and you sort of ask, where's Johnny? And they've gone, he lost his job. He's had to fly home.
Yeah, right.
So had to take the family home. So suddenly it went from, we were still working. You could still kind of do stuff. But there was always the sword of Damocles hanging over your head. You didn't know if you were going to turn up Monday
and
still have a job.
Yeah, right.
You know, we saw it with Lehman Brothers and Nomura.
Yeah.
You know, come out on the Canary Wharf. You come up onto the big outside of Canary Wharf there, and you got the Lehman Brothers building.
Yeah.
And we walked out, and early one morning you walk in, everyone's going in, off to work. I remember coming out to go to a meeting, and it was about 10 o'clock, I think, and just streams of people coming out of Lehman Brothers.
Wow.
And that was the day. And then the doors, because they had the building, doors shut, locked up, big Lehman Brothers on the roof I think Nomura might have taken over that part of the business. Big Lehman Brothers on the roof, I reckon within a week it had gone.
Gone, yeah.
So a huge amount of people and, yeah, pubs and bars did quite well in that period because everyone walked out and depressed and just got drunk. So, you know, that shift of just a free-for-all spending was pretty loose too.
So tell me also in that office environment when it was really heady, in an average week, what would the volume, how many kilograms of cocaine would the office go through in an average week?
Oh, that's a really hard question. Because it was under the counter, not over the counter.
Right, okay.
It's always very craft, different market.
But then where on the profit and loss statement can you put in the supply of cocaine as an office expense?
How did
you work that out?
Well, a lot of the trading floors had cafes on them to keep people there, so maybe it just went through as coffee.
Right. Well, it was some form of stimulant.
Some form of stimulant, I guess.
Awesome. Thanks for that, Hugh. Really insightful. We'll take a short break. We'll be back.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03-8657-7640 or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
And we're back. Joel, you wanted to talk about a piece of news that came out this week?
I do, actually. But thanks, Hugh. I think most of our listeners who have never had a chance to really see and get an insight as to what goes on in the world of finance and, you know, how that murky world of trading over the counter and all these opaque different structures work. I think there's a great insight. But look, I do. I want to talk about the dissection of the Labor Party loss in the election this year. So Labor have now completed their review, and according to Labor itself, it must cull its policies, embrace an economic growth agenda, rebuild bridges with business, and reconnect with blue-collar voters if it is to have any chance of winning at the next election. Which I think is fair. A lot of the policies were rejected. I think a lot of people were quite scared by some of the policies. And the Liberal Party did a good job of really poking that fear factor. But I think one of the things that was significantly lacking with Labor was that it was all about wealth redistribution and there was no real growth agenda to their policies, and that created fear because it was this world where someone had to lose in order for someone else having the gain, and no one really was quite sure as to whether or not they were the ones who were going to lose or whether or not they were the ones who were going to gain, and that actually popped up in their review as well, where the review cites a lethal combination of an unpopular leader, a poor campaign, and a policy agenda that was so cluttered and expensive that it caused low-income voters, the supposed beneficiaries, to fear it would crash the economy and risk their jobs. So,
and I think specifically in certain seats, there were not people who thought it might affect them. There were people who were very sure it would affect them and their jobs and their communities.
Yeah.
And when you look at where elections are won or lost, it comes down to specific seats being won or lost, and that's where Labor just didn't pick up the seats that they thought they would. And I think it was only sort of 2 hours into election night when they realised they hadn't picked up any seats in Queensland.
They didn't read the room at all, did they?
No, not at all. Mm. And it was those specific rural seats in Queensland where they didn't pick up seats where they needed to, and that was it.
Yeah, the review also absolutely, and the review also basically says that it acknowledges that the party was captured by the ideology, agenda, language of the progressive left. It advocates, in clear and unemotive language, a shift back to the political center. And this is interesting because I've mentioned this before. If you go and have a look at the parties that win elections in Australia. You can be slightly to the right or slightly to the left, but if you diverge too far away from the center, you've got no chance in this country.
That's right.
We saw that even with the Howard years when Howard and Costello, they brought in work choices. It was way too far of a shift to the right and they got booted out. Then we had the Gillard and the Rudd years, particularly when Gillard got in, they went too far to the left and they got booted out. And then this time around, Morrison was just holding center, yep, of the ground.
Abbott was a long way right.
He was a long way to the right.
And the party booted him out.
Correct. And then, you know, and then we have, you know, Labor and Bill Shorten's campaign, which was very much a big shift again to the left, and it was rejected. So, you know, and you look back at even the heydays of Labor when you had Hawke and Keating. You know, Hawke, for a Labor Party to come in with such progressive, reformative policies, you know, deregulation of the financial system, floating the currency, opening up competition for banks, and
it's all about expanding.
It was. There was a growth element to it, right? And it was all designed to. But for a Labor Party to do that, where they really moved closer to the centre, where you could probably argue that the years of the Whitlam era was very much a bit far away from the centre.
Yep.
You know, they won power and they were in power for a very long time.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
Yep.
But then we hear this, then I've got John Roscombe, who is a columnist at the Australian Financial Review. And I don't know what John's smoking here, but, you know, he says, while Labor engages in its seemingly endless soul searching, it should remember one thing. It's losing elections, but it's winning the battle of ideas. Well, John, I'm not sure what you're looking at here, pal, but the last lot of ideas they took to the election got rejected. So maybe they're coming up with a lot of ideas, but they're shit ones and they're being rejected.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So he says, however, if you judge Labor not by its election results but by its success in deciding the nation's policy agenda, on any fair assessment, you'd have to say that for at least the past two decades, Labor has been winning comprehensively. I just, yeah, once again, I'm baffled, but, you know, coming up with ideas is one thing and coming up with a lot of ideas is one thing, but if they're no good, that doesn't count, buddy.
Yeah, yep. If you're actually not able to implement those ideas, then what good is that?
Yeah.
Yeah, yep. That's a strange thing to say.
Anyway, quick note of positivity. Last night watching CNBC and then this morning on the once again, in the Financial Review, China and the US have agreed to proportionally roll back tariffs on each other's goods in phases. Now, this is a huge step.
It's massive.
In a thawing of the trade dispute that has been going on. So the amount of tariff relief that would come in the first phase is set to be signed in the coming weeks would depend on the content of that agreement. But details are still to come, but we expect that there's probably going to be some agreement. The US and China are acknowledging that they are pretty close to having some form of an agreement where these tariffs are going to start to become, will we start to be phased back and rolled back. Now, that must mean that progress has taken place. And I honestly think that this is probably one of the last little bits of worry that is hanging over this market at the moment. You remove that, and I don't know what else there is really to be concerned about other than perhaps Brexit that no one seems to be giving two hoots about.
Mm, that's right.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'd agree. We see whenever there's talk of a deal coming to fruition, markets, they're off to the races, and then get stymied, whatever happens with the summit in Chile gets cancelled, markets, you know, take the foot off the gas. But if they get a deal, it's really hard to see what will hold markets back. And let's be honest, Trump's got an election coming up this time next year.
Yeah, he does.
He's big part of what he talks about is the stock market's flying. You know, I'm creating wealth for everyone. if he's wanting to get back in, he's got to keep the stock market going up. So, yeah, perhaps he's playing a game where he's trying to just keep the brakes on a little bit by doing what he's doing with the trade deals, and then
let it go.
Maybe next year he'll just boom, foot on the gas, and
I can have an alternate theory because I'm in the personal finance. Sure. I don't have my finger on the button like you guys do, but I think this announcement is earlier than what was originally thought. I agree it's very much in the lead up to the election next year, but I think this particular piece of news has had to be brought forward because there's so much talk about his impeachment. He needs something good in the news to build up a bit more support for him.
Yeah.
So this news shouldn't have come out, but he's had to use some of his ammunition early.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
But you'll see a lot more, I think. This is my alternative theory, is that you'll see more of this come out in the next year, because it's only November next year that an election actually happens in the US.
That's right.
So watch this space.
Watch this space indeed.
That's right. Fantastic. Thanks, Joel. Thanks for the update. We'll take another short break.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
And we're back. I'll go through a quick topic today. I wanted to continue my discussion on the psychological factors.
Yeah.
In our last episode, I talked about people's money blueprints and how that can affect their personal finance, and being aware of your patterns and your behavior and how you view money. I'm going to talk about another area of kind of psychology and behavior, and it's more in our interactions with other people than anything else. It's about knowing yourself, but it's also about knowing other people as well. And that's about knowing whether you are a big picture person or a detail-oriented person.
Rightio.
Are you an outcome-oriented person or a process-oriented person?
Right.
So let's take your typical big picture outcome-based person. You might see this as a person with their head in the clouds a bit. And they're always talking about the big ideas and the big payoffs at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
How do you actually achieve it? Oh, I don't really know, but let's just make it happen and let's just do what has to be done to get the outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Versus a process or detail-oriented person who starts thinking, oh, well, this is the next action. Where's it going to get to? I'm not really sure. I think it'll get somewhere vaguely here, but I'm just going to follow this process or do these steps to get there.
Yeah.
Now, why is this important to know about your own behavior or other people's behavior? It's because you have to work together or live together or play sport together or do things with other people. And if you're on a different page to the people around you, then you're not necessarily going to be seeing eye to eye.
So you got to be accepting of others to be able to be successful yourself. Is that what you're suggesting?
That's what I'm suggesting. Exactly. Exactly.
Tolerance.
So you got to have tolerances. And if you're aware of the people around you, then you can use that to your advantage.
To manipulate.
And not to manipulate, but you can use other people's strengths.
Right.
So let's say you've got two people in a room. One is big picture oriented and outcome oriented, and the other is process oriented. There could be a big fight because the big picture person is saying, I want this outcome. We just got to get it done. And the detail process oriented person is saying, but we need to follow those steps. And the big picture person says, I don't care about steps. Let's just get it done.
Let's just do
and,
it. Yeah.
And the process oriented says, what do you mean you don't care about the steps? It's all about the steps.
Yeah.
So there's this mismatch. But if you can communicate effectively and you could recognize, I'm a process-oriented person, this person is big picture, that's actually a strength that that person has, which I don't have. So how can that person add to what I'm trying to get done here? And by for a process-oriented person to have another person saying, keep focused on the outcome, is a real strength of the team. For an outcome-oriented person, having that second person who is process-oriented is a real strength as well.
Mm-hmm.
So if you can understand that you're both coming at the same problem from different angles, you can use each other's strengths and you can work really effectively as a team together. So the next time you're having an argument with someone or a dispute or even just a civilized discussion, if we can call it that, stop and have a think. Who's focused on the outcomes in the big picture and who's focused on the process? Because the other thing might be is you've only got outcome-oriented people and no detailed people. And you might be having a problem figuring out where things are going wrong. Well, maybe you actually need to draft in someone who is detail-oriented.
Yeah.
You might be butting heads with the other person who is outcome-oriented and you need to work on your communication to say, hey, we're both trying to get an outcome here. Neither of us is focused on the detail. So let's be in unison about the outcome we're trying to achieve first and then let's have a crack at working out the detail, which is not a strength for either of us.
So you might bring somebody in or who Correct. Has that strength or...
Or you might, if you're just conscious of it, well, then you can work with your team members to actually say, we need a detailed session. Let's set aside time where we really focus on the detail. So again, about being conscious of it and having a strategy to deal with it. And similar thing, if you've got a room full of process people and no one focused on the outcome, well, then someone needs to take the lead, even if it's just writing on the whiteboard at the start of the meeting, the outcome we're trying to achieve is this.
This, yep.
Now you've got your room full of process-oriented people, let's nut out this problem. Joel, you wanted to talk about a piece of news that came out this week?
I do, actually, but I came across this article earlier this week where a British tradesman who won almost $2 million Australian, £1 million, he had to thank an anonymous shopper who let him jump the queue in order to get his ticket on just before the lottery closed.
Oh, wow. Ooh.
So this gentleman had a free lucky dip ticket that would have closed and expired within a couple of minutes of him putting his winning ticket on.
Oh, wow.
And thank you to that anonymous shopper, that man has now won $1.78 million Aussie dollars, which is the equivalent of £1 million Whoa. In the UK.
Jeez, that is lucky. That's amazing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, unlucky for the person who was behind him if they were going to buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah, they're going to buy that lottery ticket.
That's right. That's right. Hugh, what do you have?
I've got something here out of the US. University accepts peanut butter and jelly as payment for parking tickets.
What the hell?
So anyone with an unpaid parking fine at the University of Alaska in Anchorage they have the option to reduce or cover part of their cost of their tickets with peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
How does that work?
Well, the university essentially said we'll take the donations for the payment, and the idea is to try and combat student hunger. So you give them a sandwich, and then they'll distribute that sandwich to students. But
I was thinking the parking inspectors couldn't afford lunch.
Yeah,
exactly.
Well, we won't give you a ticket if you give me a sandwich. Well,
I wonder if the Victorian parking.
No, I don't think that's going to happen. No.
City of Melbourne.
No. They're pretty red hot.
Lift your standard. Lift your standard. All right. I have a funeral party in Germany who went to a cafe after the funeral,
that sounds pretty ridiculous. Standard. Anyway, isn't it? A funeral party.
A funeral party.
That prick is dead.
Yep. Exactly. But it's a typical custom in Germany, according to this article, to go to a restaurant for coffee and cake. In Germany, but after eating the coffee and cake, there was 13 people who reported experiencing nausea and dizziness and needed medical treatment. It turned out that an employee in charge of the cakes at the restaurant had her 18-year-old daughter help to bake the cakes at home.
Ooh.
The daughter baked a special cake laced with marijuana butter. And saved it for herself in the freezer, But then the mother grabbed the wrong cake out of the freezer.
Oh dear, God.
And served it to the restaurant. So that funeral ended on a high note. Which means this podcast has ended on a low note with that terrible pun. Thanks for joining us, listeners. We'll be back again with another episode. Stay tuned. Keep subscribing to our podcast and tell your friends about us.
Hopefully we might get to 1,000,001 subscribers right. next week.
I'll tell my mum.
Please do. That's right.
Righto. Thanks a lot. Cheers.
Bye-bye.